Hi, I'm Mike Webb, and welcome to the ProPublica podcast. On Wednesday, March 21st, French security forces ended a standoff with Mohamed Merah by shooting him in the head as he jumped through an apartment window and fell to his death. Merah was accused of terrorizing French citizens, killing three French paratroopers and a rabbi and three children at a Jewish school. We invited our resident national security expert and senior reporter, Sebastian Rotella, to join us to explain what happened, why French officials were not able to stop Merah even though he had been on their radar, and what key questions remain. Welcome to the podcast, Sebastian. Well, Sebastian, why don't you tell us a little about the terrorism attack in France over the past couple of weeks? What's happened?
Well, you know, as far as we can see, it's one of the most dramatic attacks that's happened in France in a long time, and the first one since 9/11 on French territory. This young man, Mohamed Merah, apparently radicalized, traveled several times as among a group of guys in the Toulouse area who traveled to Pakistan and Afghanistan, claims to have undergone training with Al-Qaeda or groups connected to it, which would fit a pattern. People have been going from Europe for years to train in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And then he begins a very disciplined, calculated, well-planned killing spree, which he first kills soldiers from a regiment near Toulouse. He targets them on a motorcycle, very professionally kills first one, then on March 11th, and then a couple days later attacks three guys, killing two of them. They're all soldiers of either of Muslim descent or of minority descent from this group, this unit that had apparently served in Afghanistan. And then his most dramatic and explosive attack, which brings down all this attention and this pursuit of him, happens just a couple of days ago at a Jewish school in Toulouse, where very brutally and methodically he attacks the school in the morning and kills one of the faculty at the school and several children in a very, you know, just very brutal attack, again, using a motorcycle and shooting people.
Well, I was going to say, so he was a homegrown terrorist from France. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, the pattern has been, he fits a pattern of recent years where he's someone who, he's of North African descent, of Algerian descent, but he's born and raised in France and has a past involved in crime and different kinds of crime, which is rather typical. You have a lot of people in the large and working class communities, in Muslim communities in France and other West European countries. You have a pattern of people who start out involved in some kind of crime and slide into extremism. The other thing that's interesting about him is supposedly he's someone who had tried to join the military on a couple of occasions. The question there being, was he really trying to join the military? Was he trying to infiltrate it? What was going on with him? But he's kind of the classic pattern that in some ways he's very Western, very French. Supposedly he went to nightclubs and hung out. He wasn't someone who was, you know, wearing a long beard and was a dour fundamentalist, but he had this very intense radicalization in the past couple of years, a lot of it happening on the internet, and then that translates to the very important and dramatic step which usually precedes action, which is traveling to train in the strongholds of extremism in Pakistan and Afghanistan.
So he actually did attend those camps, those training camps.
That seems to be the impression, both from what he said to the police during the negotiations and what the investigation has determined. Apparently, there was a group of guys from Toulouse who had gone and trained. There have been quite a few of these cases since before 9/11, they were in the hundreds, if not the thousands, of people going from Europe and from the Muslim world to train with Al Qaeda in Afghanistan. After 9/11, the numbers have gone down, but you still have dozens of people over the years going from the different countries to train, usually in, you know, what are no longer camps but small compounds, particularly in Waziristan, and those are the, you know, most of the people who have done attacks. Certainly, the ones in London had trained in those camps, and people who have been arrested in France and Belgium and other places had trained there. One interesting example: a couple of years ago in Barcelona, a group of guys who were preparing to attack the Barcelona subway system to bomb it had trained in Pakistan and returned to do the attack, but they were detected by a French informant, a guy directed by French intelligence who was inside the network, had traveled with them to train, and when he got back to Spain and realized that an attack was about to happen, it was him alerting French intelligence that allowed the Spanish to break up this plot. So it shows you to the extent that the French intelligence has people inside these networks.
And you said the French are very good at preventing these kind of activities. Do you know if they knew about Murrah?
The coverage suggests that they did. They have said that they had there were some awareness of him and of his brother. His brother apparently had been connected to a group that was involved in sending people to Iraq some years ago. But again, that's very much part of the territory when it comes to counterintelligence and counterterrorism. You know about people, you don't always arrest them. The French have an expression, "Il faut garder le réseau," which means we have to preserve the networks. The way one French police commander put it to me. In other words, the idea is you keep the networks functioning so you have something to watch. You see who's involved, where people are going, but you are on top of them aggressively enough that you prevent them from doing anything. And the French, again, have been very good at balancing this infiltration and surveillance with preventing plots before they got close to fruition. The French have also had, very good cooperation with the U.S. when it comes to monitoring networks and plots through high-tech surveillance. So the French have very good human intelligence. They're very good at having people inside the networks and on the ground. The U.S. is very good with its high-tech capacities at intercepting communications, telephone communications, and email. So there have been cases in the past, for example, where you had a guy in, say, Lyon in France communicating with a guy in Marseille by internet, and the Americans would be the ones who would find out about it and go to French counterparts and say, look, we've picked up these communications between these guys. They're talking about doing something, and that would be what would key the French into it. So that coverage between the human intelligence on the ground and the working with the U.S. has allowed them to be very much on top of these networks.
Right.
What's fascinating in this case is what went wrong.
Well, that's my next question. Is any idea how he slipped through?
Well, the key thing will be the extent to which it really was him acting solo. In other words, if he's someone who they knew had traveled and they thought had trained, perhaps they weren't sure, and they were keeping him under, a kind of loose surveillance, you can't watch everyone 24 hours a day. So let's assume that they didn't realize that he was as radical as he was. They had a sense that he was part of a group. They, the monitoring of him would be occasionally talking to informants about him, occasionally seeing communications. They may not have realized what he was doing, particularly if he wasn't communicating back to, say, Al-Qaeda bosses in Pakistan or Afghanistan about what he was going to do. That would make it a lot harder to pick up his plan. If he had a very limited number of confederates, or maybe no one who really knew what he was doing, if he did this purely on his own, obviously that becomes much harder to stop. And it's happened in the U.S. It's happened all over the West, where you have people who ended up doing attacks, like the guys in Madrid, like the guys in London, who were known to intelligence. They were known to British intelligence. They were known to Spanish intelligence. But for whatever reason, in the analysis that was made of how dangerous they were, the decision was made, these guys aren't so dangerous, we're going to have to watch them every move they make. And apparently that's what happened with this guy. One thing is knowing about someone, the other thing, and keeping an eye on them. The other one is the kind of intense manpower it would take to follow someone and be on top of their every move.
Right. So the next step is to really determine whether he was a lone wolf and whether he was taking instructions from Al-Qaeda.
Exactly. And also what happened, because don't forget there's some spacing between, the attacks that start March 11th. What happened in terms of, again, the French being pretty good at these kinds of investigations? What went on in the investigation that prevented them from finding him sooner? In other words, could they have stopped the second attack on the military men or the attack on the school? Because by then they had, there was video of him, there were witness descriptions of the motorcycle, there were things they could work with. But, as good as they are at sort of canvassing the territory, something allowed this guy, and I have to say he showed particular poise, discipline, and tradecraft, which is rather unusual. Usually Al-Qaeda attacks in the West, you have people who carry out a suicide bombing and that's it, or carry out a shooting, but they're rarely able to have the sort of cold-blooded poise to carry out a successful attack, disappear, come back, do another one, disappear, and do another one again. So also, I think he was particularly and unusually effective in carrying out this series of attacks.
And he filmed them, right? He had a video camera of what he did.
The latest news is that he videotaped them, yes, and that he was going to, or perhaps had disseminated it on the internet. You know, it's a very grim case, obviously, and just the sheer brutality of him killing these little kids, it just is beyond belief. But what's concerning is there had been a sense in the West, in the U.S. and in Europe, that Al Qaeda was on its heels, and that there had been great progress against both the networks in the West and against the leadership in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, and that's true. But again, this shows that you still have these people out there, particularly in big communities in Europe, in sort of the underclass communities where you have young people involved in crime and extremism and who can kind of move very quickly and very individually, you know, driven in large part by the internet, into action. And that's always hard to stop, and that remains a danger despite the progress that's been made in recent years.
Sebastian, do you know what radicalized him?
It's not clear to me what radicalized him. I mean, it seems, you know, what he's talked about and the information that's come out, you know, is an obsession with the usual causes for Islamic militants, the plight of the Palestinians, anger at France's role in Afghanistan, and some very French issues like the banning of the burqa and the banning of the veil in schools. He was part of a group that is kind of one of these classic groups of recent years that's emerged that is mainly active on the internet. There are groups like it in Britain that do a lot of open discussions on the internet while being careful not to actually espouse terrorism and get, you know, cross the line into law breaking. So, you know, he was part of this generation that has radicalized largely on the internet. But again, here's someone who took it to another level because he made that trip to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And that trip is important for two reasons. One, the actual training and direction and contact that a guy can make, and just the psychological aura of having made the trip and entered into contact is as important for these guys taking the next step and crossing the line into violence as whatever contacts or skills they might have picked up during their stay there.
Well, let me ask you this. One of his attacks happened on March 11th. What's the significance of that date?
March 11th is the date in 2004 in which one of the, you know, probably the biggest and most successful quote-unquote attacks in Europe happened, connected to Al-Qaeda's types in Madrid. The Madrid train bombings that killed 192 people and actually changed the course of the Spanish elections a couple of days later because of anger at the Spanish government. So the fact that those attacks had happened. So March 11th is a very important date for Islamic terrorists, particularly in Europe, because of this very successful attack. And there have been a series of attacks in places like Algeria and elsewhere that have continued. The 11 has become an important number. So you have 9/11, obviously from the United States, and there have been other attacks that are done on the 11th day of the month. So that's just a very symbolism is very important, choreography is very important, and the choice, I think, of that date is no accident. For a rampage that was supposed to continue, the information from France is that he had plans to kill perhaps today or yesterday another military man, and that he also had, there was some talk that he was going to target police as well. So this guy really had a one-man terror campaign underway.
Yeah, it really sounds like he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, and again, you know, not to generalize, but in most of these cases, you just don't have that kind of tradecraft, that kind of ability. It's much more about sort of doing an attack and one attack, and that's it. Usually, the suicide attacks. It's much harder to do, in some ways, to do an attack that you see as part of a series, because, you know, people are going to be after you. On the other hand, there's a whole doctrine as Al-Qaeda has gotten weaker and as the coordination of big bombings has gotten harder to do because intelligence is sort of swarming both the leadership in Pakistan and the communications back to Europe. The doctrine has been by some Al-Qaeda leaders urging young militants to do these kinds of attacks with firearms on their own. Because there's a sense that you have better chances of success and you can do much better at sort of waging terror on your own like that.
All right. Sebastian, thank you very much for your insight.
My pleasure.
That was Sebastian Rotella. Rotella is on assignment and traveling, so we're glad he could join us to shed some light on these events. And now for our official Say the Darndest Things Tumblr quote of the week. I announced to people when I landed that I come in peace. Who said it? President Barack Obama, as he was speaking in Roswell, New Mexico, near the site of an alleged 1947 UFO crash. All right, that wraps up this week's show. Thanks for listening, and be sure to check back for the next ProPublica podcast or our new Muck Reads podcast. For ProPublica, I'm Mike Webb. We'll catch you next time.